We've got a big interview this week with Jennifer Aniston from The Morning Show, Apple TV Plus. No, that was a very fun episode last week with Astronaut Riesman, and I was very honored to have that experience. And Mayo, thank you for helping me with that.
it was great. Good.
Yeah. Awesome. Let's talk about something we discussed 2 weeks ago on this podcast, which is I mentioned just in passing when we were talking about Apple and the FBI that, hey, didn't Tim Cook mentioned at some point that they were working on or thinking about doing end-to-end encryption for iCloud backups too, not just your phone of it from the passcode. And we were like, oh yeah, they did think about that a few years ago. Wonder where it's gone. Mayo, what's the news since then?
Yeah, so about 3 days after we posted our story, there was this big hoo-ha because Reuters posted this exclusive report where they said that Apple had stopped plans to do end-to-end encrypted iCloud backups about 2 years ago, and they said maybe based on pressure from the FBI, although they wouldn't commit to that. Or maybe it was just to customer concerns about losing data forever. But either way, they said that Apple had culled the idea and basically squashed it, which is not, because I think everyone in general was working on the assumption that this was in development, it just wasn't coming out yet. So yeah. That was kind of like keeping the peace, because there was a few people when the Reuters story came out, they were like, oh, why is this news? It's no different to right now. And that is true, right? It's not like Apple's made their backups any less secure than they ever have been. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people like you and me were working on the general assumption that this feature was in the works and in concert with their marketing messaging about being a company, you know, hypersensitive about privacy and customer control and privacy and security, that this was something that was in development. And Reuters has now basically squashed that vision, which made people upset, including me, right? Like, I wouldn't use this feature, but I think it's important for them to offer it. Like, you can't go around banding yourself as the, you know, the privacy first company, what's on your iPhone stays in your iPhone, and then you have like this massive backdoor into basically everyone's data because the iCloud backups are not, you know, truly encrypted to the point where Apple cannot decrypt them, because if law enforcement comes around or someone just steals the server and, you know, bad things happen, it's all there in plain text.
Yeah.
And what we said in our show 2 weeks ago, very poignantly, or looking ahead before we knew what news was going to happen, is like, you know, Apple has all these things like File Vault on the Mac and stuff, but mm-hmm. you know, security is only as strong as the weakest link, and iCloud backup is the only backup solution that can truly access all system files on the iPhone itself, right? Like, yeah, you can do an encrypted backup to them to a PC or a Mac, and there are some third-party tools that can work there, but on the iPhone itself, your only cloud backup option is iCloud backup, and it seems that Apple is not going to offer something that we thought they were going to do before, like the extra, like, ultimate tier of security, and it just seems like something that they should offer.
The other thing for me is that it was Tim Cook, the CEO, speaking, and it wasn't like Phil Schiller, you know, answering a question, or like Jimmy Iovine speaking out of turn. I would use this feature, because the only fear for me would be losing my password and not being able to reset it. But I would take it as like, yeah, it's worth it for me to do, not just because of my data, but, you know, when you've got contacts of other people and community, you know, that kind of thing, then it's a message to other people it's worth saving. And I would also like the ability to, like this wouldn't have covered iCloud photos, because you can see those on the web, and so they have to be able to show you those. But I don't use the website. I only use it on devices. And so I would opt in to, like, opt out of photos on the web to have my photo library, you know, of, like, my family pictures.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing to say that it cannot be granular, right? That's just...
Right. I mean, and it fits Apple.
They haven't announced anything. And if you actually go into the, like, backup options for iCloud in, you know, an iPhone settings, there's quite a lot of different toggles in there. You know, adding a few more in there, maybe with some warning signs about, you know, you actually have to remember your password for this stuff.
Like double.
Doesn't seem like a big burden, really. Like, if you want to take the line of, you know, Apple's feature slimming for the sake of convenience and, you know, not allowing complexity to seep into the system, well, I think as far as backup's concerned, you're already lost, because in that backup menu, there's so many different toggles and switches and stuff that you can fiddle about with. So mm-hmm. I don't think that's really a valid argument here. And offering you know, the highest end encryption possible is something you expect from Apple, the privacy company, right?
Yeah. And they have a feature that if you enter the wrong passcode in a number of times, the entire device resets. And that doesn't require you to have a backup. So it's possible that if that's turned on, you can risk, you know, a kid coming by or anyone and putting in the wrong passcode or yourself and erasing all of your data. You know, so they're okay with like letting you make that choice, opt into it with a proper explanation at first. So I hope that the weird thing about this story is that we just haven't heard anything from Apple since it was published of like even the framing was sort of from Reuters was like because of the FBI, Apple made this decision. And then they included that customer experience would be affected too. And that's also a concern. But it was like that wasn't really like the headline of the story. And so you would expect Apple to either say through back channels or officially, no, it wasn't the FBI, it's customer experience, or say, we haven't rolled it out yet, that's bogus. Like,
yeah, because at the moment, it's, you know, the rumor mill essentially is floating the idea that Apple's conforming to the FBI's demands, which, mm-hmm. whether it's true or not, is not something you'd expect the Apple PR department to want to spread. So
yep.
You'd expect, I it was kind of weird they didn't have any statement of any kind. Like, I wasn't necessarily expecting them to, like, confirm their work on the feature, but you'd think they could say something like, you know, we did not consult with the FBI on our data practices, for instance, or something, you know, something to that effect. But they just have remained completely silent across. And it was quite a big deal over the course of the last week, right? Mm-hmm. It was a lot of a mess embroiled into everything else that's going on and all of the other, you know, pressures about encryption messaging in the wider world as well. Yeah. Like, that's all coming up short. And we've already seen, like, Facebook delay their plans to roll out end-to-end encryption messaging because they got backlash from the government, and they still say they're going to do it, but they're, you know, they're trying to work around and try and somehow appease different parties. But then you've got Apple, who, as best as we know, isn't working at all at the moment, which is kind of sad.
Yeah, I felt good that we were out in space last week and didn't have to really dive into the story much because we were in a fortunate position where a week before it became a story, we had discussed the possibility, and all we have to do for the update is just say it's not happening, according to Reuters, Apple, unknown. But it isn't that no one's asked them, they just haven't answered yet. So that's fun. We also got a bunch of new software updates for every platform this week. So updates for iPhone, iPad, Apple TV, Apple Watch, Mac, HomePod even. So across the board, software updates, and even like software updates for iOS 12 for like the iPhone SE and stuff like that. So a lot of updates. The big thing across all of that is that rocky software updates in the fall are now like in their polish state. I think everyone agrees with that. So hopefully. And then there are a few key fixes here. Like, for example, there was a small sort of story about Apple's ultra wideband chip in the iPhone 11 family of phones that was a privacy issue because you couldn't turn it off. And that's been fixed with a toggle now in 13.3.1, right?
Yeah, because this blew up like just before Christmas because people were seeing that even if you turned every switch off in location services privacy settings, then the location arrow in the top corner in the status bar would still flash every now and again mm-hmm. on the iPhone 11 devices. Apple released a statement saying that, oh, that's the UWB chip. And obviously, while the possibility of like data leakage on that chip is pretty low because, you know, it can't actually see much, it can just tell itself where it is in relation to other devices in the area. Still, it's kind of stupid that if you turn all the switches off, the location arrow will still pop up and say it's finding your location. So, you know, that resolves that by incorporating UWB into the location switch in privacy settings. So now, if you do switch everything off in the privacy screen, your location arrow won't show up ever as it should.
That's right. And then the screen time hole has been closed. And this was where it wasn't really a bug. It was just, you know, it wasn't like an update took something away, but an update added a new feature, but then didn't consider a certain implementation of it. So that's fixed now.
Yeah, there was like dumb stuff where you could add a contact through a different menu and you could just still message your friends when it was supposed to be shut down.
Like, yeah, and the new feature there was like managing contacts, right?
Oh. Yeah, exactly. Like, because it's specifically iOS 13's communication limits feature, which allows you to control who you're talking to or the device, who you can message and stuff on the device and at what times. So you could say like, you know, don't chat to your friends between 8 p.m. and midnight, for instance. So you have to go to bed. And if you, you know, were an entrepreneurial kid, there were a few different ways that immediately popped up as to how to circumvent those restrictions, and they've, you know, cracked down on them.
Yep, and then there's some more fixes in the iOS update and iPadOS update where they're for issues with mail and issues with push notifications and Wi-Fi. There's also on the HomePod now, there's Indian English Siri voices for the HomePod, and I believe HomePod's coming to India now too.
It's kind of yeah, it's kind of weird. They added the page to the Indian the App Store website, but when they added it, it just said check back later for availability. So they like added everything, including the price, but they didn't add the release date.
Okay,
so we don't know exactly when it's launching, but obviously, seeing as they've added support for the language in the software update, you'd assume it's soon.
Yeah, and then in watchOS, it was version 6.12 that has no new features, and they strictly say security updates recommended for all users. And then on macOS 10.15.3. They say these are updates to for multi-video stream editing performance for the new 16-inch MacBook Pro, and then another update that addresses the Pro Display XDR. So two very specific changes there. Unrelated to this round of software updates, there were also a few stories that happened around the release. And one is that just as an over-the-air update without changing the software, the Apple Card has a new feature. This is in the Wallet app. There's now the ability to natively to export transactions to a spreadsheet. So this is like as basic as they could go, like baby steps. But the whole thing was, you know, people wanted, when Apple Card first launched, the ability to share their transactions with other apps so that you can do some like budget tracking and that kind of thing. It wasn't there, still isn't there. But at least you can make a very basic spreadsheet, right?
Yeah, the very basic CSV, comma separated values format, which is literally you're like the name of the transaction, then a comma, then how much it was, then a comma. That's like the fundamentals of this entire data format.
But why did that take so long?
Who knows? At least it's there. So what you can do is you can export the CSV file, and then you can go into one of your financial tracking apps like Mint, and you can press import, and you can drag it in, and then it will fill up with the transactions. You can feel very 20th century technology about the whole thing. They have said they're going to add another file format, which is OPX, which is like slightly more sophisticated at some point soon. Mm-hmm. And that will be through the same menu. You just get to pick whether you want to export CSV or as OPX. Realistically, you know, this does offer a solution, but it's not what people want, because what people want is like something that's automatic. Because, you know, this is the modern era. This is the modern world. And, you know, manually having to export a file to then have to drag it into another app is just a stupid annoyance that you shouldn't have to go through. And so what people are hoping for is that Apple adds some sort of like, you know, sanctioned API, like Apple Card Kit or something in the software. So like Mint, let's just take the Mint app, it could update to integrate the Apple Card API, and then you could give it permission, similar to how you give a permission to like HealthKit database stuff.
Yeah,
and then feed that through, and it would just go through the device. They haven't announced any of that stuff, but they did say that they were like working on support for third-party apps like Mint and stuff. I don't know if this is what they meant by it, because if they do, they should definitely go back to the drawing board. But realistically, something on the scale like a fully fledged, like, you know, transaction history API is something that wouldn't come up until like iOS 14, right? It's a pretty big deal to get all that in place. So
yeah,
if they do have something like that coming, then, you know, expect to see it like in the summer.
That's cool. And then we also saw, we sort of like recognized the end of Apple Maps rolling out their big 2.0 version in America, in the United States last December, a few weeks ago, because it was pretty much finished from what we could tell today. And that was within their goal of by the end of the year last year. Today, now that we're approaching the end of January, they officially acknowledged that, and so I guess there was more work to do. And they also hinted at where the new Apple Maps will go next, right?
Yeah, so they said it's coming to some countries in Europe later this year. So hopefully that includes the UK. We are geographically in Europe, and we are, you know, one of the biggest markets in the European region, so... And also, if you just look at the trend of Apple products, the UK is normally pretty high on, you know, where stuff is prioritized, because it is an English language country. So
right,
it's quite easy for, you know, American developers to verify and test that the UK maps are good, because it's in the same language. So you don't have to worry about like localization issues as much. So fingers crossed it will come to us, because, like, you know, rolling out Apple Maps to the US, the new maps to the US, is great and all, but if you actually, like, thinking of places where Apple Maps needs improving, the US should really be not number one. It shouldn't be high priority, because, as has been discussed many times before, the quality of data of Apple Maps in general is pretty high in the US, and it's worse internationally.
Indeed.
And
yeah.
The UK is, like, you can, I'd call it, like, patchy. So, like, London and the surrounding area, which is, like, where I live, is normally pretty good. But when I go and visit family who are, like, you know, more north and less, you know, basically the further away you get from London, the data starts to, like, thin out, and you can still navigate to from a location to another one, but you start noticing there's less points of interest around. If you search something nearby, it doesn't show up as much. So I'm looking forward to this new mapping stuff. And as much as it's about the, you know, the higher textured mapping tiles where they're showing the geography and the foliage and the grease and the greenery and better road mapping, it's as much about the fact that as soon as Apple owns the mapping data, they can roll out fixes and improvements much faster than they could do with the old model, where they're relying on, like, a bunch of third-party providers, and they'd have to, like, negotiate with them every time they need to get something changed. So
yeah,
this is good for everyone when it comes, and, you know, it's just a slow plod. But if they said, at least they said multiple European countries, so we're going to go from US to more than one. So
that's right. Yeah, I've really enjoyed over the last several weeks where they've added stop signs and traffic lights, and it helps with how Siri communicates, because Siri will say, turn at the stop light or turn at the stop sign. And it's a better point of reference than what was there before. But also, like, I drive with CarPlay, so I've got the big screen in the middle of the car, and it shows those objects. And it's like, okay, look, you can look at it and quickly glance at it and say there's two stop signs or two stop lights, and then there's my turn. And it's just, the more context you have when driving and, you know, not having to think about it as much, and you know, it really helps. So I've appreciated that. And I also, I really hope that from this change, you know, because it's in the US now, there was a point where in South Mississippi, I had the new maps, but then would frequently travel to, like, Mobile, Alabama, and Mobile, which Siri still pronounces as Mobile, even though Tim Cook is, like, from that area. it's Mobile. Would have the old maps. And so it was, I would think about the fact that, like, people would drive to work from here to there, and they'd only have the good maps for, like, the part of the drive that they know the best, not where, like, the traffic is.
Did you see, by the way, there was, like, someone tweeted about a month ago, like, a list of hand-coded pronunciation adjustments for Siri. They'd, like, dug it out of the iOS code base.
Oh, wow. And I need to contribute
to that.
And it
was, like, and it basically had, like, loads of random, like, cities and countries. And for obviously where the default voice pronunciation was getting it wrong, they, yeah, like, manually added the way to speak it. But the best thing was they were, like, annotated changes. And one of them was Alabama. And it was, like, comment CEO city or CEO country. or CEO state. Yeah, that's what I meant.
I filed a radar, you know, feedback report about how Mobile is pronounced like mobile, and wrote a story on it, because it was, like, the thing that, you know, him being from the area is, like, yeah, you know, so obvious. And then even, like, smaller places around here, there's a city called D Iberville, and it's capital D apostrophe capital I B E R V I L L E, and it in maps Siri will just say Diaperville, which sounds like Diaperville, and it's just comical. Or a little small town called Goche, but it's pronounced like Goche locally. And I think the map will say Gaudier. And it's like, it's, you can't have every city in a row be pronounced the wrong way. Even if Google does it wrong, I don't even know. But it would be, that's the kind of thing that I'm hoping that they, you know, they could already have fixed that because they own that pronunciation.
Yeah.
But especially the, maybe like an iOS 14 feature would be offline maps where you can have, you know, states downloaded if you're going to travel there, mm-hmm, ahead of time and you're not going to be online. Because if you've got GPS on a device with no network, as long as you've got the map preloaded, you can navigate that map. It can figure it out. But
yeah, that's how, like, GPSs in cars worked for the, you know, between 2000 and 2010, basically. They were all offline,
exactly,
like, downloaded into an SD card.
That's right. And I would totally download, like, the Southeast, you know, driving range of places I've gone, and have it be local, because there are times when, you know, doesn't get the map of where I'm going, even though it's part of the route, and I lose my network connection. It's just like a grid, and that's it. So I would totally do that. And now that they own their data,
they
it's
can do it, yeah,
it's possible without being, you know, them having to charge to the roof, be charged to the roof, but for like licensing fees, you know, from their provider. So
yeah, because Google Maps obviously offered that exact offline mapping feature for years at this point, and you could download like the entire of the US in like a 3 gig download or something.
That's right,
crazy.
Yeah.
So and yes, it doesn't have all the points of interest, but it has all the road range. So if you know, lose data, you can navigate.
The UK would be, what, like half a megabyte? Like.
Yeah. One other, like, tangent on the pronunciation stuff. The HomePod, I have it set to British English, obviously, and it's the female voice. I don't know if it happens in the male voice, but when one of its, like, answers to when you ask it to do something, as it like loads up the thing, it will say like on it, right? Loading the playlist. You know how it says, you know, be right back. We're getting this thing for you. And in the last like 3 months or so, the UK British voice has changed. So the way it says on it, it like pronounces this like, you know, sultry whisper. It will be like, it will talk like normally. And then you'll ask it to play some music and be like, on it. And then
it's like super normal. That's great. My favorite HomePod line has always been, hold the line.
Hold the line. You need to find software for your business, but you have other things to do. Other things you'd frankly rather be doing. Cut to the chase with Captera, the website that millions of people use monthly to find software for their teams and their business. Captera simplifies the software search to just a few easy steps, and they help you make the most of the tools that you find. Use the filter options to drill down into what is relevant to your industry and compare tools side by side and save your favorites to a shortlist. Get started at captera.com/happyhour. Captera is the free online resource to help you find the best software solutions for your business. Captera helps your business thrive by making the software buy-in process as easy and as effective as possible. With over 1 million reviews of products from real software users, discover everything you need to make an informed decision. Search more than 700 specific categories, from project management to email marketing to even something like running your own yoga studio. So how do you get started? Go to Captera.com and drill down into a subcategory like app design, home building, insurance, or banking. It's completely free to look around and explore what's available. Don't trawl the web. Captera brings everything together into one simple-to-browse directory. Visit Captera.com/happyhour for free today. Find the tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Captera.com/happyhour. Again, that's Captera, CAPTERRA.com/happyhour. Captera, software selection simplified.
Some other news this week, a couple of apps that came out this week. The first one I'll talk about is the new Fantastical. It's version 3.0 everywhere, but it's a pretty big update for most of the devices and so on. So it's one app now instead of individual apps that you buy separately. And it's available on the iPhone, iPad, Apple Watch has a new version, and the Mac. And those used to be like, you paid like 10 or 20 bucks for the different iPhone and iPad versions, and then you paid for the Mac version, like 60 bucks or so. And now it's one single subscription that's monthly or annually for new customers. And it's like $5 a month, which is probably like, you've got to really be a power user of your calendar to do that, you know, in terms of what you pay for other stuff, services, or $40 a year, I believe it is. And so that's more in line with,
which is still quite steep.
Yeah, quite steep, but that's more in line with, like, I know that I'm a Fantastical power user. So for $40 a year, I can just look at it as like buying the Mac app once a year. And the biggest thing for me, and it helps that I've been a customer since 2013, is that I know from the history of like development that around 2013, 2014, 2015, there were a lot of new versions and app updates. And then since then, it's been much slower. Like, you get some of the basic stuff, but there just haven't been like new features. It's just been like OS support, and not always on like day one. So my hope is that the new subscription model will help in having updates. And this is what they promise, you know, every quarter or so. I don't want to put a time frame on it, but you won't go like 3 or 4 years without a big update to each version. And
I don't mind apps moving to subscription models, mm-hmm. that, as long as they're offering like, you know, value for money. Like, it doesn't actually matter, like, because people are just like, oh, I hate it, all apps are going subscription, or this one's like overcharged. It's like it it varies from case to case, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, a powerful Kanban system could easily be worth $40 to you for every single year. And assuming they do keep updating to it, you'll be pretty happy. But mm-hmm. if it's not, then it's fine. You can, they actually offer a decent free app with, like, that's one of the things I think Fantastico has done well in their transition to subscription is they don't actually lose any features, right?
If you've paid for Fantastico 2 on any of the devices, then on that device, from what I understand, you keep the features that you paid for.
Yeah.
And so you just don't, I think they kind of like blur out or tease some of the stuff that you could get with a subscription, you know, which maybe like you want to be able to turn that off. But you don't lose anything so far because it does replace the old app version. It's like the same SKU from the iPhone, and now it's universal, but, yeah. Because
there are some like bad offenders where you have an app and it have been, you know, $10 buy once. And then they'll change the subscription by just making everyone switch to, you know, a $5 a month model. And, you know, regardless of whether it's $5, $10, $2, it's just awkward because what someone originally bought was buy up front. And then suddenly they have to then lock all the features away behind a subscription. So at least letting people like have an upgrade path where they're not actually losing out on anything should hopefully like calm a lot of the like normal backlash to this kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, it's been there anyway, but it's like my Twitter feed has been like their support feed. Because people are passionate with this stuff. And I get it. Like, you know, like in college, I would not be able to afford a $40 a year calendar app. I also wouldn't need it, I don't think.
Yeah. I mean, I don't need a $40 calendar app, so I don't buy it, right? Yeah. Like, that's ultimately where you've got to land on this stuff. It's like, sure, the developers are going to price their apps at what they are. And if you think it's worth it, then you can buy it. And if not, you have to look elsewhere. Like,
yeah, and it's a business, and it's tricky, and it's like hard, you know, there's no one answer to it. They do a free trial for the first time on iPhone, iPad, and Watch now, which they've never done before. And part of it is that you also get the app is free for the first time ever, where you can just download it and use some basic features of it and never pay for anything, even if you didn't pay for an old version. You don't get as many features that way, but you still get to try like the core features, which for me are natural language parsing for creating events and things like that, and a timeline view that's really easy to read and versus the built-in stuff. But yeah, I mean, if you don't want it, you don't have to buy it. And my guess is that when you go to subscriptions, you probably do have fewer customers than you had before.
Yeah.
But hopefully you've got more reoccurring revenue where your audience is now worth more to you, and you know it's worth doing the app. Because I got the sense that the app was not in its previous state was not worth putting a lot of effort into. And one thing they did do is that for the watch, it's now an independent watch app, and they moved to having their own like Fantastical account so that you can integrate with a lot more calendars. And for the watch, that means that it can be its own app when you're not on your iPhone or with your iPhone and you're on cellular or just Wi-Fi, that it can update to the watch. And then, you know, so there's a lot of new things that they can do with that. But they didn't just like take the old app and say, now it's a subscription, you know. It's like they at least made it into a new version. So, but I am a fan. And I will say, like, despite pushback to subscriptions, it's way better than like a text editor that never changes. And it's just like you're subscribing to a right to use this, you know, forever.
Is it a bit of a higher level? I think the general move to subscriptions for like all applications, which Apple is 100% encouraging, by the way, because there's the money incentive, get an extra 50% if you stay for a year. So you can literally make more money when the customer's paying the same amount. So,
that's right.
You know, if you want to blame someone, blame Apple.
Yeah.
But like, I think at a high level, what you're seeing is that as more of these apps move to subscription, each individual customer is buying less apps, but they're probably spending the same amount of money just on fewer things. So you're basically having to like pick and choose what you're really invested in. Like, you know, calendars are really important to me, so I'm going to subscribe
that's right,
to this.
Yeah.
Whereas before you'd buy like, you know, 5 different apps for $10 each and then they'd sit there for 3 years and do nothing. So as long as you're getting like, you know, regular updates for your money, I think it's fine for them to do it. And what they'll have is all of the kind of people that were, you know, basic users or medium users will fall away, and it will just be like, you know, hardcore power users, you know, centered applications, which is fine. And if the market works, some other calendar apps will come in below that are cheaper and, you know, just play to the strengths of what people want as like a less of a power user model. Mm-hmm. Like that's the best outcome for this stuff is, you know, the hardcore apps double down on that so they can actually continue providing, you know, powerful, rich functionality for their core customer base. And then the stuff that's on the side, they either switch to Apple solutions or there are other apps on the store that, you know, fill those gaps, because Calendar is a pretty big category. So if there is this massive upswell of people that leave, you know, developers will notice and they will fill in there, but there's like the time lag element and stuff like that. But in general, I think that's what you're seeing with a lot of subscription stuff, is that overall people are like buying less apps, but each individual app that they are like, they're like handful of five apps or whatever that they really like, that's what they're then just paying more money to.
And that's right.
For the most part, it seems to be working for people. So I don't think the tides are going to change anytime soon.
Yeah, it's like Ulysses has moved to subscriptions in 2017 and hasn't changed. You know, so it must be going pretty well. I will say this is the last episode of Happy Hour that's free. You must now subscribe with your wallets. For you, there's a new app that you covered that is totally free. So you just download it and use it. But you do need a very expensive phone to use it. Otherwise, it doesn't have any purpose.
Well, technically, it could work with the 10R, which is less expensive.
But not a 10, which not is 10. Probably why you can't sell it, I guess. I don't know. But.
Yeah, so it's the app's double take. This is, it's kind of a funny story, because in the September iPhone event of 2019, Apple included a demo from the Filmic Pro developers of multi-camera recording inside of the Filmic Pro app. And at the time, they said it would ship later in 2019, before the end of the year. 2019 came and went, and they did not ship it. And now at the end of January, they've shipped the multi-camera recording as an independent application on its own, which is free, but with the promise that it will get integrated into Filmic Pro later this year. So for whatever reason, they missed the deadline, and they've decided we're just going to release this feature on its own rather than holding it back and waiting.
So does free now mean not free later? Like the app will go away and you'll need Filmic Pro
They weren't entirely clear on the situation. Imagine what they're probably going to do is just keep Double Take free and then just use it as like an advert for Filmic Pro.
Yeah, right? So and then do any future features in Filmic Pro for it.
Yeah, so I assume Double Take, because Double Take is just basically focused on the multi-screen recording stuff. Mm-hmm. So it's not going to get many more updates, I'd imagine, right? Like, you're just getting the core functionality, being able to record two things at once in a few different layouts, and then there's like a button in the app which zooms you over to buy Filmic Pro. So it's basically just like a free advert for them, which is fine. But the actual app works pretty well. It's by no means the first like dual camera recording app to hit the App Store, because that API became available with iOS 13 September. Mm-hmm. And we even talked about on this show a couple of the ones that came out, you know, in the September-October timeframe. Like,
I had a rocket launch recording interrupted by a phone call with one of these apps that because it wasn't the built-in camera. It didn't say what was recorded.
So it's not the first one, but I do think it's a pretty good effort. You can get a split screen, you can get picture-in-picture. And one of the ones that this one does that a few of others don't is that you can record picture-in-picture, but the actual outputted files will be separate video files. It's intended for like proper work, right? So you can film two angles, and then what you actually get in your camera roll is two video files, one of the front camera and one of the back camera.
So the PIP is more like for you to capture yourself in a preview, but not
it's
but
like
it's
a preview. Yeah. So you can choose to like burn it in and have the PIP on the same video, but the mode which I think they like encouraging is the discrete mode, which then, because what they're intending you to do with that is then to take it into a video editor later and cut it into, you know, to get the angles as you want artistically, because that's kind of what they showed at the September event. Was they were recording that saxophone player, and they had the ultra wide and the wide angle shots, and they were like gonna, obviously they're recording both at one time, but then later they're gonna go in and edit and, you know, get the scenes that they want. So that's the idea of the app. It also has like a histogram and a few other little things in it. It's really nice, and it is free. So
nice. I need to test using this app and have someone call me and see if what I've recorded gets saved or not, because that's what blew my mind a few months ago and watching this the rocket launch. And I've also since then turned on no unknown calls, and then also use, like, I have my carrier's spam block service that you pay for. So I learned my lesson there. But yeah, this looks really cool, and I do want to use this kind of thing. And like, from the moment I saw it, it's one of the things that sold me on the new phones, even though it worked on the 10S. Was, you know, it's a really cool feature. And
one thing that this Double Take app does that the others I've seen don't do is that if you're on the preview screen, you get four windows. So you can actually preview what the telephoto, the wide, the ultra wide, and the front camera look like at the same time.
Mm.
And what most of the other apps do is they're limited to just two video streams at once. And even this is when you actually go to record, it's 1080p on both streams. But on this one, the preview window actually does have four preview windows.
So if you feel like switching to the other lens would look a lot better, you actually see what it would look like before you tap it.
Yeah, and if I actually did the classic test where you put your finger over each lens to see what it's actually doing.
Uh-huh.
And it is actually recording more than two. It's recording ultra wide and then the wide angle, and then it simulates the telephoto 2x by just like zooming in on it.
Okay.
Right? So you're getting three simultaneous streams on the screen at the same time, which is pretty impressive technically.
So including the front one, right?
Yeah, including the front one, yeah. Which is pretty cool. So that is actually part of the offering, because when they showed it in the September video, I was wondering if they were just doing like the two stream things with the front camera and then the ultra wide, and they were just cropping it twice to kind of fake it for the preview. But no, it is actually three simultaneous video streams.
That's nice. And then if you buy the iPhone 12, you can get four.
Yeah, and hopefully in the future, the iPhone hardware will improve, so you can, when you're doing the discrete recording, you can actually output at 4K, because that's one of the limitations of my phone at the moment, is that it only outputs at 1080p on both streams, and that's just like a hardware limitation. It's too much bandwidth. So one of the obvious like future iPhone features is, you know, better memory bandwidth, so you can output two 4Ks at the same time instead. Hiring these days takes time. Time that you often don't have. Sometimes filling a role is urgent, and filling a role with a quality candidate that is truly meant for your business is hard. But how do you do it? It isn't as simple as putting an ad in the newspaper anymore, and this is where LinkedIn Jobs comes in. It's the best place to post your job. Get up and running from the LinkedIn Jobs dashboard. Simply start with your company name, job title, and location. Education and grades are important, but LinkedIn also considers qualities like collaboration, work ethic, and adaptability. LinkedIn Jobs finds people that are not only qualified, but fit in with your company's culture. LinkedIn does the legwork to find the most qualified candidates so you can focus on hiring the person who will transform your business. It looks beyond plain old work skills and connects you with candidates who match your business perfectly. LinkedIn makes sure your job post gets in front of the people that you want to hire. It's no wonder a person is hired every 8 seconds on the LinkedIn platform. Companies rated LinkedIn Jobs the number one hiring platform for delivering quality hires. Find the right person for your business today with LinkedIn Jobs. You can pay what you want and get the first $50 off. Just visit linkedin.com/happyhour. Again, that's linkedin.com/happyhour to get $50 off your first job post. Terms and conditions apply. Thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring the show.
All right, a quick update on HomeKit this week. There were two big new HomeKit features revealed with iOS 13, one being HomeKit Secure Video, which has rolled out to Logitech Circle 2 and some other cameras since then, and it's pretty good. You can actually use it. The other one is much less like consumer feature-focused, but it's just more of like a security feature, and it's HomeKit Secure, or it's HomeKit Router support, so that the router can sort of like firewall off just the HomeKit devices and from each other.
So like sandbox each one from each other, so if one gets compromised, they can't like snoop on your entire network.
That's hopefully you never need it, but it's a good feature to have if one part does get messed up. So far, what we have is from the keynote last year, we heard that Eero, Linksys, and Charter Spectrum routers will support this feature eventually. And then Apple's even given out like specific models of which routers will support the feature. So that's nice. This week, Eero had a firmware update that made their routers appear in the home app. Like if you have a certain Eero router, you can go in the home app and like add an accessory without a barcode, and it'll show up with like the router icon, and then it'll give you a window to add the accessory to your home or not now or learn more. Except you still need a barcode of some kind. So I guess the Eero app will simulate a barcode in the future, and that'll be what gets you the rest of the way. But so far it's like halfway there. And then there was a Linksys update. So I use Linksys Velop routers at my house, and they're supported in the future sometime. and they had a firmware update, and everyone on Reddit, there was like this HomeKit Reddit post where it was just like, is this the version? And everyone tried it independently, and everyone's answer was no. So, oh well. And there was even discussion, like, I've got their Wi-Fi 6 router to test, and it's like this huge thing, but it works with Wi-Fi 6 devices, like the iPhone 11, for example. And people are wondering if you – it isn't on the list of devices with support yet. And so people were asking there, will that be supported? And everyone's assumption is maybe, eventually, but not yet. So if you want to test this stuff, don't use it. So that was clarifying for me, even though it wasn't from Linksys. It seems to be a community consensus there. So Apple HomeKit Wi-Fi routers coming in 2020, maybe, hopefully, soon. Q1, I hope.
The classic HomeKit delay.
That's right. And there's already been, like, every time we cover this news, there's a group of folks who complain that the feature is positive, but not there's not enough to it. And it's like, oh, okay. I guess. I mean,
it's true. But yeah.
What do you want from it? I guess. Like, maybe, I haven't thought about it. Maybe people want, like, the ability to control, like, schedule the routers, turn off and on, and things like that. I don't know. But,
yeah, I guess in an ideal world, the kind of things that like the Era app lets you do, you'd be able to do it through like HomeKit directly, and you'd be able to like ask Siri to, you know, turn off the kids' Wi-Fi at bedtime.
Or see like everyone connected and
yeah,
and
like there is stuff that you could do, but yeah. You know, they never promised it would do that, so.
That's right. And the Linksys app, I believe, so I'm using it on the 11 Pro Max, and I believe it's not optimized for Mac phones. You've got the big keyboard and stuff, so. And that's a shame because Linksys was the first company that Apple adopted for the, as like promoted as like replacement for their own routers. Which of course, at the end of the day, that's all we really want is for Apple to make airport routers again. And they could, you know, use the home app as the control for that and do all the things
Apple
we want.
The Apple Pro router, only $1,000.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. So it would be, you know, you could do like an XDR acronym for it where it would be like Apple Pro router Wi-Fi 6E. I think 6E is the new. You know, they were getting rid of like 802.11 AC and AX to make it easy. So they made Wi-Fi 6, but then they added an E to it for like the next version of 6. And that's the one that most people will get to use. So, fine. Another story this week is about the Apple Watch. There's this new Apple Watch Connected program where it's kind of, I don't really have a great understanding of this, Mayo, but it's neat insofar as the idea is that you go to a gym that's supported and your activity at the gym turns into some sort of reward, whether it's an Apple or Nike gift card or no discounts on your membership or earning back the cost of the Apple Watch or contributing to community initiatives. It varies by the gym. And they seem to require gym kit compatibility, which is not super common, or some sort of Apple Watch connected equipment. And so that Orange Theory is one of these gems where they don't do gym kit, but they do have this like community within the gym competitions that show up on screen. Like you wear their device and then it puts your effort on a big screen and you compete. So that counts. And then they're making this dongle for that to work with the Apple Watch without using their own heart rate monitor. So
yeah, it sounds like you need a gym where you can, which has like an app so you can mm-hmm. log in and obviously like associate your data with the gym's information.
Yeah, when I saw this at first, I was like, okay, cool, that is Apple Watch news, but is this them backing off of GymKit? And they were already, you know, kind of supportive of the Orange Theory thing because they had Apple representatives in that press release. The other gyms are Crunch, YMCA, and Basecamp. And my YMCA doesn't have GymKit or a program like this, so I can't be a part of it. There's a Crunch gym near me. And my understanding is that they don't have GymKit, so it's out of the. And I don't know. I'm not near a Basecamp or Orange Theory, so that's just like GymKit. I think this is something I won't get to use, even though I love the Apple Watch. But I
do have a bit. I don't understand where like the gyms benefit from this, really, because like say the one where you just get a discount off your gym fee, like. So you're saying come to the gym and we'll just give you money off next time?
I think it's a competitive benefit where there's like where I live, there are probably a half dozen gyms around that I could choose from. And so I've done things like picked by who has childcare or who has gym kit support. Nobody. But if they did, I would drive further for that experience, you know, or like
that's what they should have on Shark Tank. It's just a pitch for a gym that only has gym kit equipment.
I would be all for it. It's you can't even say you can't have you can't even have them say that it's easily recreatable because it's clearly not.
We've patented a way to have a gym kitchen.
Yeah, Apple needs gyms. That's what they need. But yeah, I think
it's because obviously, like we've seen the insurance programs where if you agree to share your fitness data and you show that you are doing X amount of exercise, then they reduce your premiums on like health insurance. And there you can see a direct correlation, right? Because people that are doing physical exercise are less likely to claim on health insurance, so they can give a discount. Whereas here it's like, you know, just come to the gym, we'll give you some money back. Like,
yeah. I don't know.
This is just like any promotions the gyms do. This is just a way to get like the Apple brand involved.
Get the Apple brand involved, create engagement where the gym is not so much of a commodity where you can like switch gyms at any point where this is kind of an incentive to use this specific gym. And then also if you've got a gym membership, it can be pretty easy to pay for months without using it. And so this can drive engagement, and they don't mind when you pay for the membership and don't use it, but eventually you're going to quit that. And this could be just something that makes the experience, you know, more welcoming, or, you know, engaging. So I hope to learn more about this, though. It seems kind of vague at this point from my perspective. And then some more things. Our old colleague, Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg, he had this report about, I guess, what we're calling the low-cost iPhone entering production in February and possibly in time for a March release. So this is kind of, is this the first time we're hearing about like a Q1 launch for this?
I think Quo said Q1 before, but yeah, like Bloomberg's pretty on it.
Yeah. So that's interesting. And
they're literally copying the original iPhone SE strategy. Like same idea, same release date, probably going to be the same price.
Right. It's not the same casing, we don't believe, but it is a previous generation that gets replaced. It's not the current device, but it's an older design that now gets modern specs. Like when the SE came out, it had the insides of a 6S. Even the camera was good. This would be like the iPhone 8 getting an update in terms of like the processor and maybe the camera.
Yeah, that's the big question mark still, is that everyone seems to say it's going to have the A13 processor, which is the latest gen, but will it actually get like a camera upgrade? Because they could just have like the iPhone XR camera in it, for instance, versus like the iPhone 11 camera.
Yeah, and how many cameras?
And it's probably going to be a one camera system, but hopefully it's the latest like optics, because then you're actually getting like good quality photos combined with the deep fusion stuff and the night mode stuff. Like all of that is hanging on what actual, you know, hardware component they pick for that back lens. So fingers crossed, it's a recent one.
And they could do Face ID, even though it has a home button with Touch ID, if they wanted to have like the Memoji phone, but they haven't done that yet. So
yeah, as well as being like a, you know, they don't have a design, existing design for it. I also just think the Face ID chip sensor stuff is still too expensive
to have
at that super low price point. Like I think they're probably pushing it with the $599 iPhone XR, and then we're expecting this to be $399. So. Mm-hmm. And if you remember from the Quo report from a few weeks ago, the successor to this one, so if we're calling this one the iPhone SE 2, the iPhone SE 3 in 2021, that one's expected to get the Touch ID sensor in the power button, right? That's
right.
Currently the current expectation, is that it will go to a full screen, it'll be LCD display, but a full screen look, but it won't have Face ID still. It will put the biometrics into the power button on the side. So that's kind of the trajectory here. So it's even next year, the cheap iPhone won't have Face ID either.
And that would be the first entry-level phone that's a new design, right? Assuming that the next one that we see maybe in a couple months is the old design again.
Yeah, if you're ignoring like the iPhone 5C or the iPhone XR's entry-level models, like the true like $399 price point models, yeah. Because the only times they've done it before is either with an older phone reduced, you know, by X amount of dollars, or the iPhone SE in 2016.
Yeah. So, all right. And just those two things alone, plus that report we had a few weeks ago about there being a product red Apple Watch in the works, made me wonder. I wanted to just put out there my comfort with predicting a spring Apple event, and previous years, it wouldn't be so strong, knowing that it is not a given every year, like the iPhone event or WWDC in September and June. But I felt like with this iPhone, it's kind of it's tricky. They could press release it the same thing with the MacBook 13-inch. They could press release it the same thing with the Apple Watch, and it could be all at different times. But seems to be that if they're all ready at the same time, then they could do a presentation if they wanted to. And they usually have some way of framing the event. Like we've had the spring event that was full of products, like the SE. We had another that was about the iPad, but it was an education-focused event. And they could obviously do some updates to services if they wanted to here. But you know, we don't know. But something that, you know, the podcast stuff, if that was closer to ready, doesn't seem like it, but that could be there. But I started feeling more comfortable about an Apple event. And then that was last weekend. This week there have been some really interesting hardware rumors that make me feel even more comfortable about a spring event happening. The first one is by way of DigiTimes, so take it or leave it, but it mentions some pretty interesting stuff. So what's DigiTimes saying?
Yeah, so DigiTimes kind of joins the bandwagon of there being a 13-inch MacBook Pro update with the new keyboard, going back to the Magic Keyboard style, and obviously we're expecting over the course of this year for Apple to transition out of making butterfly keyboards and bringing the entire line to the scissor switch mechanisms, but it wasn't entirely clear at what point in the year that was going to happen. This DigiTimes report and a few other things kind of imply that we're going to see a 13-inch MacBook Pro with a new keyboard in like soon, so before, like in the first half of the year, probably like March, April timeframe for a spring event. It doesn't seem like it's going to be changing the screen dimensions or anything, because obviously that we saw the 15-inch go to 16, but this one so far everyone just seems to be agreeing on a 13.3-inch screen, which is what the current one is, with the keyboard and some, you know, processor updates and stuff. And then more interestingly, DigiTimes claimed that Apple will move to a scissor switch keyboard for this smart keyboard for the iPad Pro, so the keyboard cover thingy. They're going to move to scissor switches, and they described it as glowing. Which presumably means backlit.
Very attractive.
Or it could be like luminous glow-in-the-dark ink. Because that would be glowing.
It could be a very handsome keyboard. Yeah. Well, is this the first time we've heard about a smart keyboard changing from its keyboard style to the Magic Keyboard style?
I believe so.
And it's definitely the first time we've heard about it being backlit.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a very expensive keyboard. That if they just kept it at the price it is, adding these things would feel okay. I hope they don't raise the price, because it's already pretty expensive, especially for the bigger version.
It is a very expensive keyboard. Yeah. That's for sure. And yeah. I think they could do it. I think they could add a backlight, because they're obviously it would use more battery than the current one, but LEDs are quite cheap on power, and they can power it through the smart connector of the iPad. So I think it would be fine from like the power perspective. It's different to like an external Bluetooth keyboard that's backlit, because they don't have any, like, you know, they're not connected to power, whereas the smart keyboard cover is essententially just draining the iPad battery.
This big 10-hour or 9-hour if it's cellular battery, right?
Like, think of how many LEDs are in the screen of an iPad, and then you've got, you know, how many do you have to power for this keyboard attachment? So I think there's no, like, battery issue there, really. This isn't in any of the rumors, but I really hope they add some kind of, like, trackpad option for the smart keyboard. And I don't necessarily mean a physical trackpad. I mean like kind of like the two-finger gesture thing on the iPhone, where you can like just like drag your fingers around, like you just like put two fingers on the keys and it would be like somehow capacitive and touch sensitive, and it would just let you control the cursor. Because that is one of the things where if you've got your iPad Pro and then you connect your smart keyboard cover, all made by Apple, when you're doing typing, which is what the keyboard's probably there for, you still have to kind of resort back to touching the screen to move the cursor around for the mouse input stuff, right? And so if they're not actually going to add a physical trackpad, which I could understand because there's various, you know, oddities about that, at least some way to like have a virtual trackpad on the physical keyboard, so you don't have to like keep going from the horizontal position to the upright position to keep tapping the screen. That'd be really welcome.
It could be pressure, like it wouldn't look like a trackpad. It could just be like pressure sensitive and, you know, gesture based, like you mentioned. Yep.
And it's certainly expensive enough to justify that. So
yeah, and DigiTimes only says for the iPad Pro, so that would not mean that the entry level, the plain old iPad, the iPad Air and iPad Mini doesn't have one, but the Air, they'd still use the existing one, and that would be Pros first and only for now.
Yeah, because obviously already we have a separation in the smart keyboards, because you have the one for the 10.2 inch and the 10.5 inch, and then you have the one for the iPad Pros because the smart connector is in a different place, etc.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And then even more interestingly, Quo comes back with some new rumors about products we haven't heard of, or at least one product we haven't heard of for this year, one that we were first to break and report on, and then one that we thought might have been Beats before, but it's back. So what's Quo saying on new products?
Quo had a report this week, and in classic Quo fashion, it was about the impact of the coronavirus on the Apple supply chain.
Uh-huh.
But nestled in one of the little paragraphs was one sentence of stuff that he expects to see this year, and specifically in the first half of this year.
Yeah.
And the context was that these new products are currently in development, and if the coronavirus got worse, they may be delayed, right? But this is what he said. We currently expect the supply chain to be working on releasing the 13-inch MacBook Pro update, DigiTimes first said, the iPad Pro update, and here's the exciting stuff, the ultra-wideband tags, so AirTags, or what we've previously reported as AirTags, Apple Tags, that kind of thing, the high-end Bluetooth headphones, and since late 2017, we've been hearing rumors that Apple's making over-ear headphones, kind of like AirPods, but for actually over-ear models. And like you said, you know, Apple was the conglomerate, basically released that in the Beats Solo Pro.
That's right.
At the end of last year. But they're not Apple branded. They don't have all the features like automatic pausing. So there is some room for Apple to do a model. And they certainly are seeing, you know, strong growth in wearables in general. So it looks like they're plotting as many wearable headphones out as they can at the moment. So maybe it's coming back.
Or maybe these are Beats Studio Pro.
They could be another Beats branded model. They could be. That is very true.
They do also have Beats Pro headphones currently that are not wireless. They can have Beats Pro Pro. Money's on that. Yeah.
And most interestingly, quote, a smaller wireless charging mat. Bring it back the AirPower.
To some degree, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like this is really, like, obviously AirPower is a big problem for them and they couldn't ship it. And it doesn't seem like just 1 year on, we're going to be any different situation of shipping what they promised with, you know, a single charging mat that can charge three things wherever you place them. That still seems implausible. And
if Apple were to buy one of these companies that are more obscure, that's demonstrating what AirPower promised, except they can't do the watch part because Apple doesn't do Qi on the watch yet, then that would be like, okay, here we go, AirPower is coming, but they haven't done that yet. And so with what they have resource-wise, it seems like that's out of the picture.
Yeah, and they're still not technically doing three devices, right? Like,
right.
So it's kind of an asterisk. But Quo's wording is kind of stupid because he says smaller wireless charging mat, but he doesn't say smaller relative to what. And Apple does not make any wireless charging mats at all, whether they're AirPower smart or not. So we don't really know what he means here. A smaller wireless charging mat that can only charge one thing? Well, there are quite a lot of charging mats in the world today that seem to work pretty normally.
What if it's just for, it's like, it's smaller, like really smaller than what you can buy today because it's made for AirPods. And it's like a little tiny little mat, like a little pillow that you lay your AirPods on. Because they sell, they already have solutions for iPhones through their partners. And some of those have like lay the AirPods here, but they don't have anything, they don't do anything first party for anything wireless yet. But if it's smaller, like really smaller, and they want to make a unique contribution, it could be like an AirPods case size little mat.
Like almost like it would be like an AirPods dock, but it's
that's right.
Wireless charging.
It's like an AirPods product accessory, yeah.
Yeah, like a stand for like a nightstand for your AirPods or something.
Yeah, and if you put your iPhone on it, like it wouldn't draw much power because they don't need to make this higher than 5 watts, and you have to really line it up right with the phone, so it's not really meant for that. But the AirPods, it's the size of the AirPods case. And
yeah, when I tweeted about this, I got a few people saying that I wouldn't mind, like, because what we pictured in the story was just like the Belkin case, the Belkin charger, which is, you know, like a circular pad, right? Where you put the phone
like a little cup holder, coaster.
Yeah, exactly. And it hasn't got space on it for anything else. It's just like a saucer, right? And when I tweeted this, a few people replied saying, oh, well, I'd just like one of those that could reliably charge wherever the phone's placed on that circle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have extensive involvement with wireless chargers in general, but I don't think that what they're describing there is really solvable. Like, if you look on the iPhone, the wireless charging element is a circle in the center of the device, right?
Yeah.
So and what you have is a circle that's, you know, only very slightly larger than that size of that Qi charger inside the phone. So the issues with placement are more about where the Qi charger is in the iPhone, not about the desk accessories.
Yeah, you would need to put like multiple Qi chargers along the back to have full coverage.
Yeah, the way the AirPower Mat didn't have this problem really is because it was twice as tall. So you'd have more wiggle room of where the phone could be laid because it was basically tall enough such that the phone would sit inside it. So the middle of the phone would always be contacting the mat.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're looking for something specifically smaller, like these circular design things, you know, that's just not possible geometrically. So I'm still as confused as ever about what this would be. And if this was a Quora report about Apple making a wireless charger, it would obviously have these details. But because it was like the one sentence in the 5-paragraph report on the coronavirus. And
again, because Quo is not doing this for like Apple rumors, he's doing it for investors and his insight into telling you what, not just the Apple, but the suppliers, how they'll be affected by events. Yeah.
So we have to basically stay tuned on that one to see if he does follow up with, like, you know, here's all the manufacturers making the wireless charging mat for Apple.
Yeah, well, that's exciting. I mean, it's more than nothing. I had to reread it a few times to see, like, is this really what I'm seeing, you know, when it came out. Last thing I want to mention this week, a couple of things that we've done. The first one is a new app from you called Eject Bar. Is that right?
Eject Bar?
Yeah, which has history in this podcast. You've made another app, like, for this podcast, basically, with tabs to links as a browser extension for Safari, where you take a bunch of tabs that you've opened up in Safari, and then you click a button and you make them into like a bullet list that you can put in, you know, our shared notes document, for example. This is another app that has some roots in just me and you talking before this podcast begins each week. What is Eject Bar?
Yeah, so it's very simple. It puts an eject icon in your menu bar, and when you click on it, you can see all your connected drives that need ejecting. So normally, if you just have a laptop and you plug your drives in, before you unplug them, you have to remember to like go into the Finder and press the eject icon. Otherwise, it like complains to you that you might lose some data because the disk wasn't ejected properly. And for me, that was really annoying at the end of the day because I'm basically pressing the same button every single day to eject my Time Machine drive. And so this is what Eject Bar does, is that if you click it once, it can just show you your drives and you can eject them individually. But if you right click on the icon, then it ejects all your drives in one go, and then you can just carry on with your life, and it will eject really, really quickly. And then for me, if you're in a situation where you're basically ejecting at the same time of the day every single day of the week, you can set a schedule so they'll automatically eject at that set time period.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
it's a very simple app, but it kind of like makes something that you do every single day very, very convenient.
Yeah,
we've what macOS offers.
Yeah, I mean, part of it is like I went from the iMac Pro to the MacBook Pro, and I'm using an OWC Thunderbolt 3 dock to be where all of the cords for things go, like the monitor and speakers and the SD card and my Thunderbolt drive and Ethernet. And then from that, there's a single cord that both powers and connects all those things to the MacBook Pro, which is like something that you really appreciate, is one cord with all those things. But I can't do all those things and just like sometimes the drive. So I do the drive as part of that, and then it would be two cords if I didn't do that. And so I was using like the manufacturer's app, which was like, this was the point, but the menu bar icon was blue. And apps in the menu bar should be monochrome. They should be black if you're in light mode and white if you're in dark mode. And this was just blue. It was not good.
Yeah, and the OWC one had like an annoying installer. You had to like restart and do all this weird
Yeah, I was like Windows level.
And so the aim for a jet bar, the reason for existing was, you know, an eject icon in the menu bar that adapts the system appearance with a monochrome icon that doesn't get in your way and can be installed via the Mac App Store. So that is what I made, and it's $1.99 if you want to buy it.
Yeah, I liked your you're telling me about when you're doing this, you're going to look at the app that I was using, and because it required like so much rebooting and like putting things deep in the system that was like gross, you wouldn't even install it. So.
I didn't want to. I don't like installers for a menu bar utility. I'm like,
right.
I'm always worried when they have those custom installers. Like, it's fine. Okay, you download the thing, you double click on the DMG, and it loads in Finder, and then you can drag it out. That's fine.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But when you then click on the thing, and it's like, we're going to install for you now, and we're going to take up 87 megabytes of your disk space,
and you have to reboot.
You have to reboot. So I'm like, okay, this thing is going to put files on my computer somewhere that I have no idea where they're going. It's just, and those configuration files are just going to be there forever. And that was enough. I was like, oh, I'll just do it without it. So my like specs were make it so it can be sandboxed in the Mac App Store, which then means it doesn't require any crazy installation or anything like that. And the app is like under a megabyte because it's meant to be like really, really small and lightweight. Uh-huh.
It looks good. And one thing that I like about yours is that you can quit the app if you want to. With the one I was using, it was always running. And if you killed it and with that activity monitor, it just came right back because it was doing all that weird stuff. And so the only way I could kill it was to delete all the files with the AppZapper app to like find where everything went in weird places, and then empty the trash can and then kill the process, and then it would leave the menu bar. So I like eject bar the best. So that's something that you've done this week that I think is really cool and wanted to promote. And then this week I've also got a new episode of Watch Time out, my podcast that's like 95% about the Apple Watch. And my guest was our colleague, Michael Podick, and it went great. He has a lot of experience with just like movement and activity and being, you know, doing things like gymnastics and playing different sports. So it was neat to hear his perspective of how he went from that to adopting the Apple Watch versus like me, who doesn't have that background, and then discovered it from the Apple Watch. And if that isn't enough, he also recently went on a mega ski trip where he used the app Slopes for ski tracking and recorded like how many miles he had skied that day and like his fastest speed, which is like over 40 miles per hour, which is crazy for your body to me to think about. Like on my bike, I do half that at peak going down a hill, so it must be something. And then he wrote a review for Slope, so we've got that linked in the episode. But just search for Watch Time on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Overcast, and you can hear that and the previous 13 episodes. And also, if you like Happy Hour, you can subscribe in each of those places too. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at ApolloZach. That's APOLLOZAC. And Benjamin, you're on Twitter at
BZAMAO.
Last week, I got to do that for you. And I did not Zed. And if you have any feedback, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. And both Benjamin and I will see that. And we like to reply to all of our feedback. So please do. If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe. If you haven't already, leave a review if you really love it. Or if you're a super fan, you can recommend it to a friend. And we really appreciate that. We'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.